So there's a stats out there that says 91% of happy customer would be happy to give referrals, but only 11% of salespeople ever asks for referral. So if you think about it, there's a good 80% of referral that's just go by the wayside because the salesperson is hesitant to ask. Don't ever hesitate to ask for a referral or get in people's face about referral because you're actually making your, if you done, you do your job well, then you're actually making your buddy look good.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Build Your Book podcast. This is your host, Aaron Baer and Double Tank. Every week, we bring to you stories about the legal profession to help lawyers build a better book of business, a better practice, and a better life. Let's get started. Hello, hello, this is your host, Double Tank. Before starting this week's episode, I wanted to let you know that the Build Your Book Academy is launching its next cohort. Our goal has been to help lawyers like you learn best practices and start using them in your busy days to grow your book of business, and with it, your confidence and happiness in this career. Whether you're an associate starting out, or a partner at a big law firm, or even a solo practitioner, we've got different tracks depending on where you are in your career. We have some incredible stories coming out from our pilot cohort, which we can't wait to share with you in the coming weeks. But if you're interested in joining the next cohort, make your way to buildyourbook.org/academy, that's buildyourbook.org/academy, to learn more and apply now. And now, on with the episode.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Build Your Book podcast, and we've got another amazing guest today. With us is Agnes Lan. She is the VP Sales at Change Connect. She's also the CEO at Small and Mighty Summit, and she is doing a lot of incredible stuff in the sales space. So Agnes, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, Aaron.
All right. So Agnes, you know, you are the VP of sales. You spent a lot of time in sales and you work helping other people with sales. So sales is obviously something you know really well. What excites you about sales? What makes you interested in sales in the first place?
I have a little background by myself first, guys. I am an engineer by trade. So I have an undergrad in engineering and I am, you know, excited about solving problems. So when an opportunity came along where I did business school and I came out to do management consulting, the thing that sort of excites me is solving people's sales problems. Where does the revenue come from? How do you go about finding, you know, blue ocean versus red ocean? So dealing with a lot of, you know, pricing issues. So it sort of piqued my interest. So from my consulting standpoint, actually I started as a consultant. So from a consulting standpoint, I always want to get sales projects. So when an opportunity came along for me to start my own company, right away, I'm like, no brainer. It's gonna be a sales consultancy. I'm gonna, because you know, you gotta feed your own interest first, right? If you're starting a new business.
Absolutely.
So I went and, you know, that's when Change Connect got started. We saw a niche in there where in the small mid-sized business space, you know, there are a lot of business or business transformation, sales transformation left over where the big five doesn't want them, right? They, you know, there's not enough meat, there's not enough margin for the Deloitte of the world to treat some of these small mid-sized business. So that's sort of where we came in and we sweep those business away.
And that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you talk about the small and mid-sized business space, which is where I play a lot. You know, I work with a number of very large companies, but most of my work is small and mid-sized. And it's interesting because the value that, you know, some of the bigger players are able to offer just isn't there, like, you know, at the price points they need. And I find it's a really rewarding space. And you talk about, you know, solving problems and how it's exciting. And to me as a lawyer, you know, like your background as an engineer, you know, or in sales, that's what we lawyers do, right? We solve problems. I think once I started to understand, you know, how to do my job well and start, you know, really building relationships with clients, you know, really what I say is I get paid to solve problems, right? Sometimes they're more fun to solve than others, but generally, you know, someone is coming to me as a lawyer, they've got an issue that they need help with, they don't know about, and my job is to solve it for them. And then I get the pleasure of watching them succeed, you know, watch their business grow. And especially with small and medium-sized businesses, sometimes you really get to see that. And I'm guessing in your space, Agnes, because you're doing, you know, sales transformation, you really are actually getting to watch them grow. So I'm curious for you, you're working with these companies, they've hired you. Why are they hiring someone like you in the first place? Like, what do they need help with, and when do they actually come to you?
So we have two, I guess, major aside from enterprise. We deal with SME the most, the scale-up phase, especially the VC-backed startups. In there, a lot of times, our model is one where we find, let's say those mom-sized business guys, let's say they get to about, I don't know, five reps. And because these founders really have no sales experience to begin with. They know what they're doing. They know what they're doing well, and they are very passionate about, the AI space, for example. They know the tech, they're building the tech, but they don't know how to manage their sales staff. So now, before long, with five reps, they have five different compensation structure. Everyone's rolling in different directions. That's when they realize that they have an issue, right? So then we go in, they will hire us to go in and we'll, really get the five reps to be rolling in the same direction, whether that's five reps, whether that's three reps. But what we're finding lately also is at the startup phase, when they're ready to invest in salespeople, we're also taking those cases where we're actually hiring the first sales team for them, really defining what the sales process is, really saying, hey, what personality and or skill sets are we looking for? Because not all sales, when we're looking at our database of job description and posting the other day, there's like 30 some odd postings that we have for the various different sales tasks. So they're not all salespeople. That's not a thing, right? Are you a business, are you an SDR? Are you a sales manager? Are you a strategist? Are you a inside sales? Like, there's just so much involved in the world of sales. And I think that's why it got me really interested in sales, because it really, back when I was sales, I'm not dating myself, back in the day, when I was thinking about it, it always is about, oh my God, that person just got it. And in my mind as an engineer, I'm like, no, that person doesn't got it. That person knows something scientific and logical about the sales pipeline that the rest of the peers haven't figured out yet. So now let's figure that out and make it repeatable. So really it's about helping these small mid-sized businesses get a roadmap to success and not and make the whole sales journey repeatable and predictable. So that's sort of our niche.
That makes so much sense. There's so much good stuff you said, and there's lots I want to dig into. And thankfully, I'm taking notes because otherwise, there's no chance I'd be able to remember this all. So it's funny, one of the things you said early on was, these founders have no sales experience. They were good at ideating and building that business out, getting it off the ground. And all I was thinking was, if they were a lawyer, they'd still be doing sales because legal is nuts, right? Here you are, people that went to law school, probably had a background, a few engineers. I love hiring engineers. But most people probably a poli sci, some kind of arts background, maybe business, and went to law school. So no sales training so far is really my point. And then practice law, and now they're salespeople. Their second job that they get compensated for, that they spend time on, that they get no training in normally is sales. And so these founders, if they were lawyers, they'd say, well, I just have to become a salesperson now. And yet, of course, these founders are smart enough to realize, you know what, this is not my area of expertise. I either need some help from somebody like you, or the smart approach, of course, is hire some people that actually do this for a living and then seek some help from people like you. So, and I know Dowell, when you started working with the legal space, I think you were just sort of shocked by the fact lawyers were wearing all these hats and there really weren't salespeople at most law firms.
Yeah, that was absolutely shocking. First of all, this idea that lawyers don't do sales, that this idea that sales is beneath them, that these systems and processes are all crazy, is something that I think a lot of lawyers still struggle with. And we're seeing it a lot in our academy. They come with a lot of preconceived notions of here's how sales is supposed to be done. They think it's sleazy. They think it's slimy. They think, they have all of these different preconceptions. And really, we're breaking it up. And one thing I really like what you talked about is that you just threw a bunch of buzzwords that I don't think any lawyer really understands. Inside sales, what is that? What's an SDR? What's an AE? What does sales strategy look like? All of these terms are complete Greek. to a lot of lawyers. And actually, I'm wondering if you could actually define some of these terms that people can appreciate that sales is not just a carnival, but that there's real structure and real method to the madness.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. When I'm talking, there's this really odd perception of salespeople. Salespeople are either on the golf course a lot and doing nothing all summer, or a salesperson is just taking people out to lunch. Then the flip side is these salespeople is a dirty word. They associate sales with pre-used car salesmen or shoe salesmen. And although, you know what? Those are really respectable professions, guys.
Yes, yes.
So I'm thinking like inside sales, for example. Inside sales are people inside, obviously sitting in the office, but they make outbound calls. So it's a lead gen. It's a lead generation mechanism to make sure that their salespeople have appointments to go to. And sometimes, depending on how the inside salesperson do, they pre-qualify and or not qualify the actual lead to make sure that it's someone that would buy from them to begin with. So that's sort of where we come into is sometimes, there's this, and I know Dell, you are in marketing too. So there's this push-pull relationship with marketing. Because there is a conversion ratio between the leads to sales conversion ratio. And a lot of times, in order to meet that ratio, sometimes marketing pass over unqualified leads. And in my mind, I always talk to my clients this way. Guys, it's not about the size of your pipe, but it's the size of your qualified pipe that makes sense to work on. Because if marketing is a one-to-many relationship and sales is a one-to-one relationship, if we pass over unqualified leads, then my one-to-one relationship is full, but they won't be fruitful if these people aren't ready to buy. So it actually makes more sense for them to stay in the nurturing stage in marketing until they are ready to buy. So the relationship between sales and marketing is oh so important. And it really should be a collaborative relationship rather than one that's lobbing the lead over the fence. So
I love that. And what you're pretty much talking about is the beginning of what we call a funnel, where you have marketing kind of creating content, creating ideas, being on social media. And if you're a solo practitioner or if you're a partner at a firm, that is the marketing phase of the funnel, where you're kind of, planting, where you're inviting people to come into your world. Maybe you're giving them some sort of a lead magnet, which I guess we can get into because I'm sure you deal with that stuff all the time. And then you bring them in, and when they're ready to buy, that's when they become qualified, from what I understand. And that's when you engage them a lot more intently. Is that how you see the gradient or the funnel kind of flowing?
Absolutely. Because sales is tough, guys. Like sales is there's a lot of numbers. I was in another podcast yesterday where we were talking about numbers, and it's all about the conversion ratio from stage to stage and how do you drag them forward. And guys, don't educating people about not dragging them to the proposal stage when they're not ready, because that you're just pushing them to a no faster and getting them through the funnel. Back to what you're saying, Del, getting them through the funnel in a way that's ineffective. It isn't just about pushing people through the funnel, right? It's about getting them to buy. So yeah, there is definitely a lot of science between the various different stages. And our job, when we go into an organization, especially with us, right? We're pretty scientific that way, where we're saying, when in the buying customer buying journey, from needs recognition to buy, if you think about it, especially in the in lawyer space, in the B2B world, right, where a lot of times these people are shopping. These people mean customer. Whoever the buyer is shopping, they're not going to shop more than three law firms and or three firms at once. So when you think about it, you really should have a 33% closing ratio, if not more than that. Right, I always push my B2B firm to be at least sitting at 33% closing ratio, if not 40, 50%. So when you think about your top of the funnel to bottom of the funnel sitting at 10%, there's something you're doing wrong. Because if you're going up to bat with your 1 in 3, then why should you be sitting at 10%? There's something that you're not doing right. So when you look at the funnel and you break it up into various different stages, you can see where your leads are dropping off, right? When you see where the leads are dropping off, you look at all the stages. Generally, it's not the stage that drops off. It's always the last few stages where the leads are dropping off, where you're looking at and say, where are they dropping off? And how can I do better in order for me to change the conversion ratio in that stage? Because incremental changes in those stages allow for a higher conversion ratio top to bottom. So, you know, I absolutely, you know, if the audience haven't done that with their pipeline, do it, because it's such an eye-opening experience and it is transformational. Like once you figure out those little nuggets, and you're not even doing like earth-shattering changes, right? You're doing incremental changes that's going to make huge revenue difference in your business right away. So those you know, soul searching exercise is always fun to do.
I love this point. And I, you know, just to make this very apparent to the audience, because what you just told them is something quite advanced for most people. Unfortunately, you know, like analyzing each stage of the funnel and seeing how you can increase conversions at each of these stages, to your point about how a small incremental change could dramatically, could have a transformational impact on your business. You know, here's a very simple number. If you are converting 2% of visitors to your site onto a phone call and your entire business is built on just that, and you make that number go from 2% to 4%, you think all you're doing is increasing the conversion rate by a little bit, but you've just doubled your revenues if you can maintain the same type of conversion throughout. So, you know, these numbers are nothing to laugh at. You might think 2% to 4%, that doesn't really mean anything. And really, if you're a solo practitioner and you've, say, got an email list of 100 prospective customers and you're converting 2 or 3% each month, and then you're charging maybe $5,000-$6,000 per client, you've just built a six-figure business. And there's so much potential at the margins. There's so many things you can do, very small, subtle things. You know, sometimes the simplest thing could change the needle for you, and you might not even realize it. You know, Agnes, I'm really curious from your perspective, what are some very simple, quick hacks that you've been helping your clients implement and that our clients or our listeners can use right away? Like, what are some simple optimizations they can make in their funnel, even if they don't think what they're doing is funnel optimization, or they don't have a funnel formally laid out, but what are simple optimizations you'd recommend people do?
You know, the first one that comes to mind is definitely in the marketing side, where you're putting up collaterals. So a lot of, especially sole practitioners and or smaller businesses, they tend to only push information out. So what we call broadcasting. So pushing information out is very one way. This is, you know, information about me. This is a feature of my product. This is why I'm good, right? But things like that doesn't really draw relevance. It's like TV. Oh, this is a 72-inch TV. Okay, right? It have no dimension. It's 72-inch TV. It doesn't tell me anything. But if you change it, you know, that collateral to a more customer-centric collateral, then that's where it makes a world of a difference. So whether it is a use case where someone can read that use case and realize, oh yeah, I had this problem, this person can help me. Or it could be an article that draw relevance to someone's situation where they can also submerge themselves into that case or that whatever marketing collateral you're doing, whether it's white paper, whether that is podcast, whether that is, you know, we're doing something called the Choose Your Own Adventure deck, which gets a bit sophisticated. So it's definitely more relevant content. And I think this is how I would sort of put it in perspective from a TV standpoint. A 72-inch TV is a 75-inch TV. 75-inch TV is a 75-inch TV, right? It is what it is. But the 75-inch TV, the weekend before Super Bowl, is huge. because that have emotional relevance to the 75-inch TV, making him the coolest kid on the block, inviting his friends, have nacho party, and you know, it is the center of that party. And you know, the you know, he you know, getting the kudos and enjoying the Super Bowl before Super Bowl weekend with his buddies. And to him, now he's linking that 75-inch TV to a badass party that he's gonna throw this year, and everyone's gonna talk about for years to come. But it's not the TV, it's the emotion that people invest in turning the TV into something that they can relate to. That's a buying trigger. So I think that's my long, short way of saying definitely more relevant content rather than flat content.
And actually, this is a point that, sir, I'll hand it over to Aaron right after this, but you're making a very important point here. This idea that people buy on emotions and they justify with logic later on. And this is such an important point. And I think a lot of lawyers and attorneys feel that, well, there is no emotion involved in decision-making from the client's side. And I wonder if you can speak about the emotional element of why no one should ignore the emotional element of from the buyer's side.
Oh, absolutely not. Like I think, I just told, you know, we talked to you about the journey, the drawing about the journey. And in terms of the buying, customer buying life cycle, they will generally whittle down to about three in the shortlist, because there's just not enough time to do more than that. And when you think about the three, and let's be honest, guys, those three are going to be qualified to do the job that is on hand. They're not on a shortlist three that is not qualified to do the job. So you now, whether you're qualified or whether you got the right stuff, whether you're technical enough or not, whether you are, you know, the best, it's not that important when it comes to the shortlisting, because when you're shortlisted, they believe you have the goods. So now, what makes you stand up above the other two, right? You can't tell them you're more qualified because they already qualify you. So what new content, what else they have to hang on to give, to award you the contract instead of someone else, right? It's fairly simple.
Yeah, this stuff is not rocket science. And I sort of joke, you know, we're not teaching rocket science, but it may as well be rocket science to lawyers, because, you know, they're coming at this with just no background, no knowledge. And as lawyers, we're so used to facts, right? You know, how do you win a court case? The actual answer is emotion too. You win with facts and logic and all of that, but to influence people, whether it's a judge or somebody else, they're human, and humans are actually influenced by emotion and storytelling. And so as lawyers, we've bought into this terrible narrative that it's all about logic. And there's truth to that. You need to formulate good arguments. But even as a corporate lawyer, when I'm negotiating is all about emotion and all about understanding the people as people, right? Not people as robots. And we don't learn about this in school. We think, oh, the law is factual. You know, judges are objective, and that's all nonsense. You know, in some countries, they are certainly less objective than others. But even here, right, they are influenced by a narrative. And we all know behind the scenes, many judgments are, you know, reverse engineered. You know, what outcome do they want? We'll get to the logic, you know, accordingly. So I think with lawyers, and I fall into that trap sometimes, we're so logical and we think that the world is based on that, but it's not, right? That's not how people buy. And there was a point you made earlier, Ines, so many great points. One of them was just measuring your conversion, going back, you know, a few comments ago. And lawyers and law firms are generally not good at all at measuring anything. We're good at measuring how much time we spent on a billable task, because that's all we know how to do. That's our only form of compensation and incentives. They're all based on that typically. But when it comes to anything else, and as you would probably be stunned by the lack of data or the lack of clean data that lawyers have. And when it comes to sales and business development, I can tell you that for, you know, when I was an associate, I could spend up to a certain amount of money, a decent amount of money, on whatever I wanted. Like each time, not in the aggregate, each event, each lunch, dinner, whatever, I think I had $500 I could spend. There was no expectation of any conversion, which quite frankly is fine when you're starting out. That's not a bad thing as a younger lawyer. They wanted me to build my network and stuff, but there was no measurement. There was no tracking. It was just do some stuff. It might work. It might not. I'm not tracking. You're not tracking. Qualifying leads. That wasn't a concept I'd ever heard of. It was just haphazard. And of course, it's so hard to know you're failing, or put more nicely, it's so hard to know that maybe you want to change something if you don't have any measurements, because then you have no data. And then it's really easy to tell that story about it's not your fault, you know, the planets weren't aligned the right way that day and all sorts of reasons that had nothing to do with you, when the reality is, and I've seen this with lawyers, you know, it's like, hey, you really suck at phone calls, for example, or hey, you never actually asked for anything.
Yep.
So it's no wonder you haven't gotten anything. You know, you're out there thinking, I don't want to be that sleazy salesperson, which is fantastic, because who wants to be that person? But in the process, you've sort of not closed or not ended conversations with the person on the other end, realizing that you have something to offer. And so it just sort of makes me laugh sometimes, because if you're not measuring it, you can't do anything, right? There's nothing there.
You're exactly what you're saying in terms of the, I have a funny stat. So especially in your industry, I think it might be one that's worth thinking about for the audience. So there's a stat out there that says 91% of happy customer would be happy to give referrals, but only 11% of salespeople ever asks for referral. So if you think about it, there's a good 80% of referral that's just go by the wayside because the salesperson is hesitant to ask for whatever reason. If they have a good experience, if you think about it, I'll give you a classic because I don't want to ask for referrals. That's so needy. But here, I'll give you an easier example to digest why this is important. We get asked which restaurant what's your favorite restaurant, Aaron? Every day.
Yeah.
And then you tell me your favorite restaurant and I enjoy it and we'll enjoy the same restaurant, right? It's referral is the same way, you know? I have this problem. Can you refer me to a lawyer? You know what? My buddy's having issue with his car dealership. Why don't I introduce you to my buddy and you guys can figure it out. Don't leave me out of it, but you guys figure it out. I have every confidence you can help my car dealership friend. That's how referrals are made. That's how networks are built. So don't ever hesitate to ask for a referral or get in people's face about referral, because you're actually making if you do your job well, then you're actually making your buddy look good. So absolutely, if you haven't asked for a referral yet, try asking for 3 referrals this week.
And Agnes, how do I do that? Because I know one of the things, you know, I know you deal with this in the sales space too, and we'll get to that in a second, but one of the things we see time and time again with the lawyers we're working with, or lawyers in general, and I went through this too, you know, I had to overcome a lot, you know, mentally, you know, from a mindset standpoint, there's this huge fear of asking or imposing or doing these things. And then the result is it's just easier not to do it. And so how do you ask for a referral? Is it as simple as saying, you know, hey, Agnes, it sounds like you really enjoyed working with me. If that's the case, like, is there anyone in your network you think might be good to make an introduction to? Like, how do I go about doing that? And when do I go about doing that, I guess?
Mm. So the when is the easier part. So I'll deal with that question first. When is always when the client is happiest. So it could be at the beginning of your engagement. It could be at the end of your engagement. So a lot of times people have this misconception that referral should be asked at the end. And I wouldn't subject yourself to just that. I think there are going to be throughout your engagement, because your engagement, especially in your world, it could be, you know, 3 months, it could be 18 months, right? So I mean, if you wait for 18 months, it's a long time when you've already built up a good relationship. So when you have your good relationship and when there is something you just resolved with your client that you believe no one else could have done, that's a good time to ask for a referral. In terms of how to ask, that's a bit trickier, I think I would say. Number one, I said, it's better ask than not ask. I don't care, you know, for you to put sophisticated language around asking. Just ask. That's number one. But a lot of times you have to understand, even when you're whoever you're asking, your client, even if they want to give you referrals, they're not in the business of giving you referrals. So they're not going to be very good at it. So you got to give them better instruction than give me a referral, right? You got to, you know, I'm really trying to get into the fintech space. Dal, I'm really trying to get into the fintech space in the US, you know, especially in Dallas. Do you know any startup that had just been VC, you know, that just got their seed round or Series A round that needs a sales playbook in the Dallas area? Then that way, Dell right away says, okay, let me think. Do I know any VC backed, you know, either just seeded or just Series A that need a sales playbook in the fintech space, right? So in that way, he's just going through his Rolodex to look for things that match what I just described, rather than, hey, can you give me a referral? Then Dell's gonna think, yeah, I can, but no one comes to mind, right? So just be a bit more specific when you ask. I think it goes a long way.
That's such a great point. And it's funny. It sounds so obvious and trite when you say it that way, but I haven't been doing as good enough of a job as I listened to you talk as I should have been. So that's part of the reason I love doing this podcast is I get to learn each week from people. And yeah, you know, it's a lot easier when someone asks me for a referral when I know exactly what they need, because then I can think through my mental Rolodex or my CRM or whatever and try to figure out who is the right person. Where it's vague is where it's harder, right? You know, it's harder. And with Build Your Book, you know, we've really, I think, done a good job of helping lawyers understand referral networks. That's one piece. Learn how to systematize, as we talked about earlier. What is a CRM in the first place? How do you move people along? How do you do all those sorts of things? You know, we've seen huge success for the people in the Build Your Book Academy, because the stuff that it sounds so obvious isn't obvious to lawyers. It's obvious to you. It's obvious to Double. And I've learned a lot from you know, my time with Double and other sales experts in the last year or two. But it's not obvious to lawyers because no one's trained me on this. And you know, when you spend all your day thinking about law, you know, you're generally not exposed to people doing this. And most lawyers just aren't engaging in any kind of network science, any kind of strategic, systematic network building. It's very much, I met this person, and some people are, you know, like the getting that people moved along, the asking for referrals, that scares them. And then once they've built up the courage to ask, unfortunately, as you said, they're asking at the wrong time. And I've done this too, right? Like waiting for the end. And you're right. It's obvious. Again, I say obvious, like in hindsight, it's obvious. It's obvious you should ask when the client is happiest, because they're most likely to say yes. But I think, again, and especially if you're avoidant with these kind of things and you're making excuses, then you'll say to yourself, no, I'm not going to ask now. I'll wait for it to be over. But when it's over, might be when they get the bill. And maybe your bill is much higher, and maybe now they're not so happy, or insert whatever. So, you know, all these things I think are just such great advice, Agnes. And I know you do sales training with professional salespeople, right? You know, you're going in, Change Connect is going into these companies, working with existing salespeople, not lawyers, but actual salespeople. And as I understand it, salespeople struggle with a lot of the same stuff because sales isn't easy. So I'm curious, what are the biggest issues sort of, or some of the, a couple of the big issues you see, whether it's mindset, whether it's execution, whether it's systems, what are some of those issues that you see? Because I'm guessing they all apply to lawyers as well.
Yeah, so actually we've been working with HubSpot a lot lately, and HubSpot have published a couple of interesting stats in terms of 2021 sales. Because 2021 sales is a little weird because, you know, it's the first year, probably full year, that we actually have to go remote sales or hybrid sales. And the world of sales changed in the last little bit. And I honestly don't think it'll ever go back to pre-COVID. So, and I think there's a lot of good nugget that happens since COVID in the sales world to make sales more efficient. And one of the stats that came out with that report is the number one fear, not fear, but the thing that salespeople fear or, you know, not as good. Sure. 41% of them, I think the actual question is, what do you hate most about your job? 41% of salespeople, professional salespeople, right, says that they hate prospecting. That's the toughest part of their job. And then followed by, I think, 32%, which is closing. And those are actually very, you know, just with the salespeople that we talk to every day, is very representative of what goes on in the real world. It's tough. Like even when we go do recruiting, for example, recruiting a biz dev full time is harder than getting an account manager full time. Because people are just not good at finding new business. There's a fear of talking to people maybe that they don't know, and or what to do with people that you don't know. How do you go about building a relationship with people that you know you don't know? So it's there's a lot to the business part and the prospecting part that we get tapped a lot in terms of how do you do it better. And the closing part as well, there's a lot of technique in closing that I think people don't understand, because you know they keep building the relationship, and they don't ask for the sale. But a lot of times when you don't ask for sale the right time, once that urgency is gone, then there's no need for whatever you're trying to sell. And then the relationship you just built your relationship is your relationship. You can keep it, but it will not flourish into a deal. So there are actually very specific buying signal for you to realize when to go in for a close. So, and not dragging it too long, because there's also a philosophy from your earlier talk with Dell, where the whole idea of funnel. So if you can only have so many active deal in your pipeline, in your funnel, because you only have so many hours in a day. So if you keep hanging on to dead leads in your pipe, then you're wasting time and you're not focusing on putting new leads into the pipe and really recycling them through the pipe and have a healthy active pipe rather than a dead pipe. Because it's not just about number of leads in your pipeline, right? So that's definitely maybe a little bit of nuggets that I would.
No, that's fantastic, Agnes. And you know, you made that point earlier and just reinforced it in a great way, right? Not all leads are equal, right? And I think lawyers, you know, we started out in our Bilderberg Academy just saying, you know, let's build some habits, right? Just getting more used to doing this stuff and really seeing some growth there, a lot of growth with the lawyers we're working with. And then we sort of said to them, great, well, you know, now that we built this habit, you know, we got to remember not all time is equal, right? Not every prospect, potential client, I guess as we'd probably call it in law, prospect in sales, they're not all equal in terms of where we should be spending our time. And I always say, look, if you want to go out for lunch with somebody because you really like them, do that. But that's not business development. That's personal time, you know, but and time is the scarcest resource for humans and especially for lawyers, because we're not salespeople by day. We're lawyers by day and also salespeople by day and maybe by night. And so, you know, that time is really scarce. And one of the biggest reasons I think a lot of lawyers struggle with business development is they don't allocate time to it. And so obviously, you know, we talk and teach people about time blocking and actually treating this as part of their job. But even if you're going to allocate 20 minutes, 40 minutes, whatever, how you spend that time matters so much. And I remember when I was starting out on my growing my book of business journey, you know, you'll take anybody. You'll take the crappiest client who reaches out to you or whatever. And you know better. You can sort of tell, or maybe you can't tell right away, but early enough on after a couple of clients, you know which prospects, you know, which leads, potential clients aren't going to go anywhere. But I would still chase after them because, you know, you want that. And there's something to be said about learning about what it's like to get a client, right? If you've never had your own client before at a law firm, there's a bunch of stuff you got to do. You got to get them closed. You got to onboard them. You've got to bill them. You got to keep them happy. So there's value to start, quite frankly, in taking on a couple of clients that at the end of the day, even if they don't pay, you've learned about that journey, right? Because you got to get some of these mistakes out of the way. Better to get them out of the way on lower value from a monetary at least standpoint clients than not. But I no longer chase dead leads. And it's funny, I've had a couple in the past couple of weeks where person reached out to me. So, you know, already qualified, you know, potential prospect. Did the initial call, there was interest, wanted to move really, really quickly. Sent them the follow-up after I hadn't heard back from them a couple of days later. They had said there was urgent. I'm ready to move. I'm ready to help you on an urgent basis because you told me it's urgent and I'm a service provider. And then they're not getting back to me on a rush timeline. And after that first follow-up, when they don't respond, I just ignore them. Like it was already a low value prospect in terms of what they needed. And it's funny with most of them, they don't come back. I actually had one who just came back, you know, some stuff got in the way, life got in the way, but I'd already written that one off as something I wasn't going to waste my time chasing because especially given the small amount of work they needed, early stage company, like, not worth my time chasing you down and wasting all this time. I've got bigger fish to go after. I'm happy to work with you, but I'm not going to waste time, you know, chasing you. And that's also where we, and I'm sure you do this too, you know, the more you've automated, right? The more that follow-up process has been automated and systematized, well, maybe you still, you know, quote unquote, can go after them, but without having to spend any brain power or real time on your end. And I think for lawyers, you know, this is obvious to you, Agnes, but for lawyers, everything is manual and is just a different world.
Oh yeah. No. There's so much sales tech and martech out there right now. You shouldn't. Like, as soon as you have the discovery call, subscribe them into an email sequence, and then the way you go. Like, there should be none of that. None. For whatever. Like, maybe even like couple hundred bucks a month. Like, that's not even your billable, guys. Like,
exactly. It's almost mind-blowing. And quite frankly, I've been guilty of this for a while. We've automated a lot now at my new firm, like the firm I'm working at, Renault & Co., you know, much more tech savvy. We use an actual CRM, you know, all my stuff goes through there and it's been great. And obviously automating some of that follow-up is super important, but these aren't even things on people's radar, right? Lawyers are waiting to have time to do the follow-up manually. And the whole point, as you know, Agnes, is like, you got to make use of your time. And here we are, billing by the hour for the legal work we do. There's a reason maybe lawyers haven't adopted as much technology as a result, but we're not valuing our own time, right? Mm-hmm. We're not valuing our time at $500 an hour or $800 an hour or $400 an hour. Because if we were, we wouldn't be doing this stuff manually and chasing after people that way, right? So we're not turning our brain on when it comes to how am I spending that time? And there's some great data from Clio, you know, one of these legal tech practice management companies, talking about how much time each day lawyers are wasting on non-billable tasks. And there was another survey recently just on how, you know, the cost of that, right? Like, and I know for a lot of younger lawyers or new partners or whatever who are trying to grow their book of business, the biggest challenge is you don't get to do sales full time. You're still expected to hit your billable targets and bring in work. And as you know, Agnes, better than I do, bringing in that work takes time. So you're having mm-hmm. no results, you know, from the business development, no monetary results, I should say, up front. And yet your billable hours are potentially declining. And so if you're thinking about this listening, going, I want to build my book, I don't have time, how the heck am I supposed to do this? Well, part of the answer is you make time by using technology, by building good processes, and not doing this manually, right? You know.
Absolutely. You're breaking my heart, Aaron.
There's a reason lots of lawyers tell their children not to become lawyers. But I think, quite frankly, you know, the future of this profession looks so different, right? It doesn't need to look like the traditional way. And the traditional business development was a lot of schmoozing and a lot of, you know, in-person stuff. And there is obviously so much value in the one-on-ones in person and the dinners and this. But especially in the post-COVID, I hesitate to use that word because we're not done with it. But in the post-COVID world, I mean, so much more is happening digitally, you know, through Zoom, like we're recording this podcast now, you know, through social media, through all that sort of stuff. And that means you can do this at scale and do it efficiently. So I would challenge anyone listening, if this sounds intimidating, it's not your fault. No one taught you. That's what we're here for. You know, that's what the Build Your Book Academy is for. That's what Agnes's company is for. If you have clients who are looking to grow, or if your firm or other, you know, people you know in your network. So Agnes, you know, you talked about referrals and making the ask. So I'm going to put you on the spot. Who, if someone's listening, if they have a client or themselves, like, who's the right person for you?
From a law firm perspective, we're generally working with organizations that's about, I would say, 20 partners or so. We don't want the bigger law firms. So where there's no systems in place. So if you have, within the law world, if there's no CRM, less than 20 partners, then you know it, people are frustrated with sales, that's the firm to refer us to. But in terms of, you know, from a client out of the law world, we're working with any startup that's about $2 to $10 million that is trying to systematize their sales process, that have salespeople, probably between 2 to 8 salespeople that need some retraining and refresh and really trying to figure out how to do their job more efficiently in this hybrid sales world. And the good part on not on the law front, but on the small mid-sized business front, we also actually have grants that we can tap into to help them cover for our training costs. So it's really a good journey for them to be on to upskill some of their salespeople to make them successful.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think one of the best things as a lawyer you can do is help your clients in ways beyond just law, right? So I'm always trying to find out, you know, what are my clients' needs? Is there someone in my network I can connect them with? And I work with a lot of clients in your space. So I'm always thinking, you know, who can I send Agnes's way? And I can definitely attest to Change Connect and the work they do. And it's been great sort of building a relationship with you over the last little while. And it's just really exciting to see the work you're doing and also realizing the impact you're able to have for so many of these organizations. So Agnes, as we wrap up, firstly, where can people find you if they want to learn more? Where should they reach out to you?
They can reach out to me directly. Actually, I am, oddly enough, I'm like only one of three Agnes Land in this world on LinkedIn anyways. So I'm not the John Smith of the world. So if you go on LinkedIn, look for me, Agnes, A-G-N-E-S, Land, L-A-N, I should pop right out. Our company email address or our company website is www.changeconnect.ca.
Amazing. And Agnes, any last tips for somebody listening in terms of like when to get started, what to do? Like, what would you say to somebody who's listening saying, I'm scared of sales. This all sounds overwhelming. I have no idea what any of these words mean. And I just want to, you know, I want clients. I want to, you know, to have a more fulfilling career, but like, I'm just scared to start. What do you say to them?
Two advice. Number one, I think, you know, when you say when to start right away, because you'll find excuse for another day if you don't start right away. So definitely right away. And the other thing that you mentioned earlier that I completely agree with, Aaron, is the idea of blocking your time. You know, I have my gang is, you know, all billable time as well, right? When you think about it. And these are people that know sales. And if they don't block their time, I can guarantee you, same idea, they won't be spending time on sales. And it's not because of a lack of knowledge. It's just because you don't think of sales as an important task in your day-to-day work. So whether that is that 20 minute, that 40 minute every week, or, you know, every month would be bad, but 20, 30, 20, 40, 60 minute that you need to block off every week, just make sure it's blocked off your calendar and make it a habit. Then that way it will come easy to you. I mean, you're not going to do it well in the first place, I mean, from a change management philosophy standpoint. Yeah. But it's okay. You know, your first pitch is not going to sound perfect. Your second pitch is not going to sound perfect. But by the 10th pitch, if you introduce yourself a particular way the 10th time, you're gonna sound pretty good, right? So it is just a matter of practice and putting yourself out there and realizing, you know what? I'm not going to be perfect the first time, and it's okay.
Love it. Not going to be perfect the first time, and it's okay. I probably need to put that up, you know, on my desk somewhere and remind myself of that. And I think for lawyers, whether it's in legal work or in business development, that's such an amazing message. So Agnes, thank you so much for being here. It's been great having you, and we're going to have to do more of this sometime soon.
Thanks, Aaron. Thanks, Dale.
You've been listening to the Build Your Book podcast. For show notes of this episode and previous episodes, go to buildyourbook.org/podcast. Our mission is to change the culture of law practice with these conversations. Please help us in this by sharing this podcast with your friends and colleagues, and help us get these ideas to more listeners by leaving us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. It really makes a difference. It takes less than 30 seconds and helps us bring on more great guests for you. Thanks for listening. Take care.